From KCUR, I'm Steve Kraske, and this is Up to Date. Follow the adventures of a boy as he swaps toys for grown-up pursuits and childhood tales of Lennon for the American dream. And if you'd like a little adventure, join a pizza hotline operator as he tries to figure out how to deal with a time traveler. This hour, the book doctors return to share these tales and more as they tell us about the books that have kept them warm this winter. So buckle up and cruise through one author's life in the form of humorous essays and have a tissue ready for our modern-day retelling of Snow White as we get you up to date after this hour's news. Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Oh, the places you'll go with a good book. And we're all about good reading today as the book doctors are here. We'll talk about the hit book Goldfinch, and one that I'm looking forward to hearing a whole lot about, the $11 billion year from Sundance to the Oscars, an inside look at the changing Hollywood system. The book doctors are Katie Stover. She's Director of Reader Services at the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library. Katie, nice to have you.
Happy to be here.
Jeff Van Gowdy is a freelance writer, editor, and reviewer. Jeff, good to have you.
Good to be back.
Steve Paul is a member of the Star's editorial board. He's also the newspaper's former book editor. And Stephen, how are you?
Steve, thanks for having me back.
Grace Suh is also here. She's senior editor at Andrews McMeel. And Grace, good morning to you.
Good morning, Steve.
And speaking of books, let's talk about words for a moment, the spelling of words. Let's listen to the final moments of Saturday's Jackson County Spelling Bee. It was quite the spell-off competition. Let's see, competition, C-O-M-P-A-T-I-T-I-O-N, competition. Not good, eh?
Way to go, Steve.
Yeah. Well, speaking of all this, this is speller Kush Sharma, a student at the Frontier School of Innovation in Saturday's Jackson County Spelling Bee.
The word again is definition.
Definition. Definition, please.
A statement of the meaning of a word or word group.
Definition, am I pronouncing it correctly?
Sounds correct to me.
Definition, language of origin, please.
The word went from Latin to French to English.
Definition. Can you use it in a sentence, please?
Yes. The speller on stage asked for the word's definition.
Definition. Part of speech, please?
It is a noun.
Definition. Am I pronouncing it correctly?
It sounds right to me.
Definition. Language of origin, please?
The word went from Latin to French to English.
Sorry. Definition. Definition. D-E-F-I-N-I-T-I-O-N. Definition.
That is correct.
And that's how Kush Sharma won the Jackson County Spelling Bee on Saturday. Katie Stover, one of our book doctors, was the head judge for the competition, and Kush was being very, very careful with that final word, wasn't he?
Yes, but Kush was careful throughout the entire spelling bee, both spelling bees, the one on the 22nd and the one on Saturday.
Well, he was so careful, and then when the word definition, when he finally spelled the word, he spelled it so quickly. I was like, after all that,
yes,
you're going to race through it.
I actually was, after going through 95 rounds with Kush, I was able to pick up his tell. I knew when he was going to spell the word correctly. He would ask for all of the parts of speech, the etymology, the definition.
Yeah.
He does that all the time. And then he says the word. And then when he says it very clearly, I know, like, okay, here we go. Kush knows what he's going to be spelling, and he spelled everything correctly. That last word was actually the best word to lighten up the mood. It was just so much – it was so funny. He's asking for the definition of definition, and they ask for him to use it in a sentence, and he's the example of the sentence. And you can't hear it on the tape, but the audience is laughing and giggling along with Kush, and he's kind of smiling, which was great because Sophia is sitting right behind Kush. She's just – been spelled out of the previous round, and she's, you know, it just lightened the mood a great deal because she'd been upset. She knew that she had misspelled her word.
After 95 rounds,
95
Katie.
Rounds total, these children did.
Mm. It almost sounded like a scene out of one of those movies like Best of Show or, those kind of Waiting for Guffman,
And there was a spell off round. Give us the backstory. Why did we get to that point on Saturday that we needed a second spell off round here?
The continuation. We needed the continuation because on February 22nd, Kush and Sophia had gone through every single one of the words in the 2014 Spell It book that the regional spelling bee officials are given to give to the students. It was obvious to Bernie Norcutt Mahaney and I, Bernie is the pronouncer, that Kush and Sophia knew every single word in that book on the 22nd. We knew we were going to run out. So we quickly planned a lunch hour where Bernie and I could select up to an additional 20 words from Merriam-Webster's Third International, which is the official source for the Scripps-Howard National Spelling Bee. So we took an hour, and Bernie and I had to comb through the dictionary. You're looking for words that aren't that archaic, that aren't too scientific or chemicals.
And what percentage of them could you spell?
Well, I offered up Axunge and Zoannin, which are the two words that the Kansas City Public Library Spelling Bee team went out on for the Corporate Spelling Bee 2 years ago. And we ran out of those words. And when we did, we had no more to give the students. So we just pressed pause on the spelling bee on the 22nd, got with the parents, figured out when we could reconvene to continue this. And we also had to call Scripps and say, what do we do? This does not happen. what do we do? We have a tie. So, and then send them both started.
Yeah. What was Sophia? What word finally tripped her up?
It was stifling. And it was obvious to the judges that Sophia I think she just had a momentary brain freeze. I can't imagine Sophia does not know how to spell that word. And you could just see the panic on her face when we gave her the word. And she asked for the definition of it. She might have unfrozen her brain had she asked for part of speech etymology or asked for the word to be used in a sentence. Maybe. Yeah. Who knows? But the minute she started to spell S-T-E, it was over right then. That was a real heartbreaker, Steve.
And so what's next here? What happens now?
What happens now? Kush is going to the National Spelling Bee, which is the weekend before Memorial Day weekend in Washington, D.C. He'll spend the whole week there. It's called Bee Week. And if I'm not mistaken, he will do a preliminary round where his knowledge of etymology, parts of speech, definition, vocabulary is given. He'll do that preliminary round. And if he gets through that, then he goes on to the big televised on ESPN spelling round.
Does he have a shot to win the whole thing? Does he have that kind of talent, do you think?
Don't all those children have that kind of shot? Okay. If you're sending them, then yes, they do.
Well, pretty good report, Katie. I appreciate that. And let's turn to the main topic today, books. And what's new in books? Anything happening in books, Steve Paul? What's new?
What's new? Books continue to be published.
They're still rolling off the press, aren't they?
There are no major developments that I can think of. We're entering the award season, so keep your eye out. I think later this week we'll hear the winners of the National Book Critics Circle Awards, but in the ensuing weeks we'll have the Pulitzers and other awards. Penn Faulkner, I think, was just announced the other day. I can't remember who won. They just announced a finalist. So, there'll be the whole series of spring book awards. But there's no – I can't think of any, kind of cataclysmic, bookstores are still under siege and
– Yeah, all that
whole,
stuff.
The whole publishing
Barnes & Noble
world
closed.
Upside down.
Barnes & Noble closed its namesake store in downtown New York. That was
we're going to see some consolidation. It's in play corporately. I think there's an offer to buy Barnes & Noble, which will mean a shrinkage probably or a reconstruction of that corporation. You know, it's but then you have anecdotal stories of, you know, bookstores that are doing really well and, you know,
absolutely. This is the story of by Ann Patchett, who has an independent bookstore in Nashville, Tennessee, Parnassus Books.
Huh. We'll talk about that in just a little bit. Jeff Angowdy. Okay. Let's go to our list here. And Grace, let's go to Little Failure. Tell us about Little Failure.
Oh, okay.
Or not.
Well, can I switch it up?
You can switch it up. What do you want to go to?
I want to ask you a personal question. Have you ever been to a reunion, Steve?
Yes, I have.
Well, and how did you enjoy it?
It was pretty good. We don't get together very often, so that made it more fun. It sucked away all the tension because you don't get away very often. Get together very often, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I feel as though the last just couple of weeks have been something of a reunion, a literary reunion for me, because Lori Moore has her first short story collection out in 16 years, and I had been a big fan of hers, you know, when I was very, very young, you know, like 6 or 7, let's say.
Wow.
No, I'm kidding. And and Donna Tartt published her first book in 11 years, I think. And really her first, the second book kind of, you know, nobody I know read it, but it was her first book, published, 21 years ago, 22 years ago, The Secret History, that made a huge impact on me at the time because I was the same age as the protagonist. And so, reading her new book, The Goldfinch, and reading Lori Moore's new book of short stories, and going back to the collected Mavis Gallant, because one of my favorite writers, Mavis Gallant, just died. Mm. And so I revisited her books. And so it was really this weird going back to
stuff you've been to before.
Yes, exactly. High school and college years. And so it's been really a very interesting revisit.
What struck you about going back and rereading stuff you hadn't read for a bunch of years?
Oh, thank you for asking that leading question.
Yes.
And Steve Paul can jump in at this point, because I think I'll go first to Bark by Lori Moore. And as I said, it is her first book of short stories in 16 years. She published a novel in between Gate of Heaven?
Sounds right, yeah.
Which, you know, I liked okay, but I wasn't a huge fan of. And it's called Bark, and in one of the stories, a character with a dog says, you know, his bark is worse than his bite. And the other character, the strange man, says, I don't know why people say that. It's much worse to get bitten. and I think it's a very leading title, because really, 16 years later, what she has to say is she was so... All of her characters had been so worried about what might happen to them in the future. You know, most of her characters tended to be young women, mm-hmm. who were involved in the arts and kind of failing at personal relationships and kind of at sea in their lives, which sounds dismal, except that she's hilarious. She's a very funny writer.
Wickedly funny.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And all of her stories are just really, really funny. It's one of those things where, you know, a really delicious tasting cocktail, and then afterwards you think, whoa, that hit me hard.
Yeah.
I had no idea what was in it. And
wow.
I think her short stories are like that. And so all of her characters, you know, were kind of at sea in their lives. Well, 16 years later, her characters are middle-aged women. Lori Moore is about a generation older than me, and I've always kind of looked to her almost as and her characters as role models,
right.
And they don't end up very well.
Hmm.
So now they're kind of in the middle of divorce, post-divorce, and things are pretty bitter. And things are a little bit...
Would you say that her male characters are creeps?
Just very disappointing. Disappointing in every possible way.
Yeah.
just kind of, you know, losers creeps, lack of integrity, just a lack of... you know, and it's very vague. They're not serial killers. They're not child molesters. They're just guys who haven't really stepped up and upheld
their end of the deal. Here,
exactly. Right? As one woman is in a long-term relationship and it's really going nowhere, and she says it's like a deck of cards, but I never had the diamonds or the hearts. I just had the clubs and the spades.
Oh,
and you know, and that's kind of how she talks. Everything is very wry, and they're very fun to read, but. You know, I got to the end and I thought, oh, okay. Well, you know, maybe these are cautionary tales and not ways to lead my life.
That's Bark by Lori Moore, her new collection of short stories,
what
right, Grace?
What did you think, Steve?
Yeah.
No, I just, you know, you're fine. I mean, I just think the way she depicts relationships is brutal and brutally honest and like I said, wickedly funny. The specter of 9/11 hangs over at least.
Yeah, there's some political stuff. Yeah.
You know, so she, you know, it's very contemporary, and much of it feels very real. A little awkward at times, but I just think she's a great writer of stories, and her early books, you know, set her on that path. I mean, people love her as a writer of short fiction, especially. Yeah,
and she's not bashing on men by any means.
No.
The women are fully implicated in their life choices. In terms of the political overlay, you know, the Abu Ghraib story and the Barack Obama story, I did find that
a little awkwardness.
I found that poorly done. But yeah. You know, one doesn't read Lori Moore for the political commentary.
Right.
Wow. Again, that's a Bark by Lori Moore from Grace Saab. Katie Stover.
Yes.
A Highly Unlikely Scenario.
Oh, this is a fun book.
Yeah?
Yeah, I'm having a lot of fun with this. The author's going to be visiting the Kansas City Public Library on March 20th. And we chose this book as part of the library's winter reading program. Stop me if you've read this one. We thought we'd go with humor after 2 or 3 years of depressing noir dystopian things. And people told me to lighten up. So I did. And I was telling someone that I think of this book as academic whimsy. It's like fast food philosophy nation.
Mm-hmm.
And in this woman's world, in a highly unlikely scenario, the world is run or the nation's run by fast food companies that all have their own philosophies or religions attached. So you really – you are what you're eating or what you're driving through and eating. And the premise and the description for this book is really far more flip than the book truly is. It's full of a lot of esoteric and arcane knowledge about philosophy and Jewish mysticism that's used to save the world. We've got a renegade librarian leading an anarchist book group, and yes, that's my favorite part. That's probably why I chose this book. with the help of a very disgruntled pizza complaint line worker and a time-traveling kid. So that sounds so flip, but there's a lot more working in here. Rachel Cantor has really done some research and taken these arcane bits of information and slid them into the plot and made it very compelling because she's weaving all these intriguing details for these characters on this cosmic comic journey. So it's got a very lively pace. It'll probably provoke far more thought than the reader expects. It's not just one of those throwaway humor novels. It's getting compared to, what did I call it? Oh, it's as if Tom Robbins loaned his sense of humor to Thomas Pynchon. So, a highly unlikely scenario by Rachel Cantor. It's her first book, and I'm really looking forward to interviewing her on March 20th at the library.
That sounds great. Again, a highly unlikely scenario. Okay. Jeff Van Gowdy. Boy Snowbird?
Yeah, I'd like to talk about Boy Snowbird. This is Helen Oyeyemi's fifth book, although she is only 29. Mm-hmm. She published her first book when she was 20 as a university student. She is sort of a citizen of the world, born in Nigeria, raised in London, and currently lives in Prague, which is apparently the place to live. This is sort of a refashioning or retelling of the Little Snow White story by the Brothers Grimm. There are mirrors here. There's possibly a wicked stepmother. And there are these iconic noun names, boy, snow, bird. So the novel begins in 1953, and it's set in New York City on the Lower East Side at the beginning. And there is a boy, a character named Boy, who's a girl, who is 15. who is being raised by her cruel and physically abusive father, who's a rat catcher, which is certainly the most fairy tale occupation I've ever heard of.
Yes.
Not exterminator, a rat catcher. In any case, at the age of 20, boy fears for her life, and she flees to – she gets on a bus and ends up in a New England town. In a very short order, she marries a man named Arturo, who's a jewelry maker. And he used to teach history. And she asks him, why did you leave the profession of history teaching? He said, history got itchy. Well, an example of history getting itchy happens when boy, the girl, and Arturo have a baby, and the baby has dark skin. And it turns out that Arturo's family has been passing for white. And, in fact, Arturo's mother has sent her one child who has dark skin, Clara, down south to live with relatives. Well, boy does exactly the opposite. Arturo has a daughter by a previous marriage. The mother died. And that daughter is Snow, who's very white. So boy sends Snow to Boston to live with Aunt Clara. Now, is boy the wicked stepmother who's becoming threatened by Snow's beauty, or is she deciding to give Snow some political education? So that's left up to the reader. This is divided into three first-person narratives. The first two belong to boy, and the middle one to boy and Arturo's daughter, Bird. And it's a very – Bird is a very winning character. She's 13, kind of reminds me of Scout Finch. She wants to be a reporter. She wants to grow up to be a reporter.
See? There you go.
It's 1953. You can still want to be a reporter.
I still do that, yeah.
Oh, that's cool. Anyway, that's a very winning part of the novel. It's a very playful novel, as you can tell. Lots of literary and historical references. Boy, the character, works in a rare and used bookshop. Steve Paul, and there's lots of historical references and literary references, and the author is a kind of a wunderkind. She was named one of Grant Magazine's best young British novelists last year, and although it's hard to describe because of the
name.
I'm
getting that impression, yes.
It's actually a very winning novel.
Yeah, you came across it how? How do you find – how did you pick this novel out of the bunch?
Looking at pre-pub materials, and it got a lot of starred pre-publication reviews, and it's actually a wonderful novel. It's extremely well written.
That's Boy, Snow, Bird.
Mm-hmm. Now, I would say that a lot of novels hinge on family secrets, and obviously the family secret about race came out right away. There is a family secret about gender that comes out at the end that does not work. It is not earned to me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But, and I won't reveal that.
Okay.
You've hinted at it.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. I did hint, Steve, but I didn't spoil it.
We are talking about books with our book doctors, and Steve Paul from the Kansas City Star is next, and you want to talk about The Sixth Extinction.
Now for something completely different. It's not light. It's not funny. It's quite serious, but it's very well done. This is Elizabeth Colbert is a writer for The New Yorker who frequently writes science and history and has been writing about the environment for a number of years. The subtitle is An Unnatural History. And what she's doing here is looking at our current environmental crisis, and trying to determine how significant the human presence and the human behavior has been on what we recognize as climate change, but really what we see in species extinction, in things like an acidification of the ocean, not just water levels rising, but the potential of ocean, or actually the movement towards a more, acidified, global waters. And she does this in a really interesting way because she's looking at she's looking at history. She's looking at the Earth's history, and looping back and forth. And she's traveling around the world to kind of look at species and to talk with researchers.
Wow.
And she starts out by visiting scientists in Panama, where the golden frog has pretty much disappeared. She goes on from there to Italy and Peru and Cincinnati and Kentucky and all sorts of places, Paris, and to look at research into fossils, into specific, you know, bats and other individual species that have that we've lost in recent centuries. But she's also looping back to the geological time, you know, the big and trying to determine through scientific research what we know and how we know it, and you know, looking at how science essentially evolved over the last several hundred years, pretty much since the Enlightenment, when the idea of extinct species sort of first arose.
Well, and this notion that she's looking at how much, you know, humans have contributed to global warming, give me a hint of her conclusion. Are we
it's a good question. You know, she's not writing a polemic. And if you look back in geological time, there have been other periods of global warming. But what is clear in this time, and the reason that scientists began referring to this as the Anthropocene epoch, essentially, we're on the verge of kind of a slow, maybe a slow moving, you know, these things happen over, you know, millennia. But it seems to be happening much faster, and certainly seems to be happening, you know, changing at a rate much faster than ever before. Essentially since the 19th century and the Industrial Revolution. I mean, we are pumping out levels of carbon dioxide by burning, you know, carbon by burning fossil fuels at an alarming rate, and we should be alarmed by that. But. She doesn't hit us over the head with it. She doesn't say bad people. I mean, she sort of does, but she's not you know, in a way you come away with it a little with more understanding, but and maybe less sort of emotional you know, hand wringing. I mean, it is we have created something that is that we don't know enough about in some ways, and I think that's one of her underlying messages. So, like I said, it's not a polemic, although she does, you know, she certainly was inspired by and references and talks about Rachel Carson at one point or other in the book. But she's careful to kind of keep it on what science is up to, how we learn, how we understand, you know, the great millennia, and kind of, you know, at one point, you know, offering the notion that, you know, in 100 million years, the entirety of the civilization as we know it will be a paper thin, coating in the stratosphere of geologic time. I mean, who knows? We'll all be gone.
Wow.
Jeez, that's terrific.
Is this a readable book?
It's
science book?
Very readable book.
Not
it
too
does.
Thick,
And she makes it readable by her travels. You know, and it's fun to kind of travel with her. It does. She does get into some details of science, obviously, all the way through. She doesn't gloss over that. So you will have to be patient or kind of curious. In areas of you know, of chemistry and anthropology and geology especially, but I just found it a pretty good read. Each chapter kind of is quick and circular and
good
makes
to know.
Good points.
You know, have you all seen the documentary Winged Migration?
Yes.
About that. So it's maybe a decade old.
It's called what?
Winged Migration, and it's a French filmmakers who built these gliders, and they followed the migrating flocks, and it's incredibly beautiful. But I was reminded of that, and this reminds me of a book that I read last week called The Wilds and Villages of Korea. It was written by a Scandinavian ornithologist, and it was published in 1930. And I was reading it for the history of Korea, but he took the Trans-Siberian Railroad from Moscow across to Vladivostok and then traveled down to northern Korea. Obviously, it was all one united country at the time, to study migrations because Korea is a peninsula at the end of the Asian continent. All these birds stop there. and on their way to the Arctic Circle and so on. And his descriptions of these bird migrations are just astonishing. Mm. Just, you know, storks in such numbers that they cover entire mountainsides, and you can't wow. see the villages, you can't wow. see the fields. Herons that, you know, cover the entire sky and black out the sun.
What does it say about Canadian geese near the KCUR studios? There's zillions of them these days.
Blanketing your
landscape. Blocking out the sun.
That shows
a bad attitude there.
Yeah. Exactly.
You're supposed to be you're supposed to be advocating.
Well, this is the whole story, I mean, of the passenger pigeons that, you know,
exactly.
covered
Kansas
the sky.
Kansas blacked out the sky.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. Yeah. And the, you know, and this is 80 years ago.
Right.
And, of course, it wasn't – there's no retrospective to it because he was writing in his time and age. And yet, looking at it now, it's such an incredible natural history document of, you know, tigers roaming the mountains of Korea. I mean, this is 80 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And to think that what's happened to the natural world since then – is
just
incredible.
Years.
And then, of course, you're talking in terms of ice ages, you know. So,
all right. Well, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our good conversation here with our book doctors. We'll get to Goldfinch. We'll get to the $11 billion a year from Sundance to the Oscars, an inside look at the changing Hollywood system, and a whole bunch more. How to Read a Novelist by John Freeman, who was a guest on this show just a few weeks ago. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. If you missed our conversation with our indie foreign and documentary film critics, you can find that at kcur.org. Tomorrow on the program, we take a look at the murder that helped prompt the development of the 9/11 system after 49 people heard the attack but did nothing. That's tomorrow on the show. This hour, we're visiting with our book doctors, Katie Stover, Jeff Ann Gowdy, Steve Paul, and Grace Suh. Grace, let's move on to another one on your list, Little Failure.
Okay, this is a brand new memoir that's out from Gary Steingart, whom you might know from the Russian Debutante's Handbook, Super Sad True Love Story, Absurdistan. He's a very popular, very good, youngish, middle-age-ish writer. And as you might surmise from the titles of his books, he is a Russian Jew who immigrated with his parents at the very beginning of that Russian-Jewish migration that mm-hmm. happened in the late 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And this is his first work of nonfiction. It's a memoir. And if readers are fans of his earlier books, you will find so much of those storylines and characters are from his life directly. And he keeps saying this as he writes the memoir. Mm. He keeps saying, I can't believe how much I stole from my life. I had no idea, you know, basically this is all from my life. And why not? He has a very colorful life. He's the only child of these Russian Jewish parents. One was an opera singer turned mechanical engineer. And apparently being a mechanical engineer at that place and time for Russian Jews was such a given that when they moved to New York City and people hear they're Russian Jews, they always say, oh, is your dad a mechanical engineer?
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And his mother was a pianist who, of course, used her piano fingers upon coming to Queens as a typist at a factory because, you know, they lived a very immigrant life. And on the weekends, they sold leather jackets. There was much made to do of the high quality of Polish leather. They sell these Polish leather jackets at the flea market, and that's how they make their living. And it's really about making their way up and all of the indignities attendant upon them, a lot of them from each other and themselves, because, you know, it's a family of neurotics. The title of the book is Little Failure, and it's called Little Failure because his mother, that was her nickname for him, Failurchka. Wow. Little Failure was the diminutive. Which is what she called him because he was a complete failure in their eyes.
Wow.
And he's their little son. His father is incredibly handsome and a real physical specimen, whereas little Gary, who was born Igor, but his parents changed his name to Gary so he would, as he says, so he would receive one or two fewer beatings in school.
Oh,
and he says my changing goodness. His name to Gary. But all of this is hilarious because Gary Steingart is a very, very funny writer. It's really like reading stand-up comedy. You would really enjoy it.
And, that sounds great. Sounds great.
And,
didn't he start writing? I've heard him interviewed. Didn't he start writing as as a 7-year-old writing stories?
Oh, he wrote he wrote his first novel as a 5-year-old in exchange for little pieces of cheese. He describes very vividly how his mother and grandmothers would wait in line for 4 hours for dried beets, or wait in line for beaten up eggplant, because this was Moscow at the time, and so these little pieces of cheese were very, very precious, and his grandmother would give him one cube of cheese for every page that he wrote of his little novel when he was 5 years old. So he's a brilliant little kid who, obviously very smart, went to Stuyvesant, but in his parents' eyes is a complete failure.
That book again, Little Failure. All right.
Can I just say that yeah. book has the most hysterical book trailer I have ever seen.
Well, he's hilarious.
Did you see that?
Yes.
He and James Franco and Pink Terry Cloth Rubs.
Yes, and that's the thing about him is he has a very Jon Stewart kind of
sensibility.
It's like David Sedaris as a Russian Jewish immigrant.
All right, let's move on here. Katie Stover, the $11 billion year from Sundance to the Oscars, an inside look at the changing Hollywood system, the author Ann Thompson.
Yes, this book was one of the most difficult books to get at ALA Midwinter with all the book buzz. I really had to fight for an advance galley of this one, and I finally did get one. But
why?
Because it's so accessible. It's very readable. I think it's going to get some very positive reviews, and it comes out later this month. It was embargoed. Somebody gave a presentation just working from this bound manuscript, and those are just nasty. Grace knows what I'm talking about. You don't want to play with those. And I have a galley, which I love, and I'm going to give to a friend afterwards. I'm about halfway through, and it's just fascinating writing. It's about a seasoned insider talks about how Hollywood really works. And the one chapter that really fascinated me the most is the one where she's comparing John Carter, that bomb, that science fiction Mars bomb, to Hunger Games. And you really get to understand how Hollywood works when it comes to the business end of promoting these films. And I must admit, I'm probably one of maybe two people in the city that saw John Carter, and that was my husband's fault. But and it was abysmal. But I think I know what they were trying to do. And then I saw Hunger Games, and it was fantastic. And what Ann Thompson does is talk about the marketing and how the films start to get – how they're created, what the producers are doing, what the directors are doing. And she talks about the mistakes that are made, and most of them are made at a very high administrative level. But it's her compelling writing that really keeps you going. And I'm just fascinated with all the detail and how this works. And there's this one line that I just underlined over here. One of the quotes is that a company would rather pay over $4 billion for an established brand than risk creating anything new. And I thought,
this has been the sadness for the last 40 years that all Hollywood can deliver us is recycled comic
stuff.
Books and stuff that is too well-known.
And that is disheartening. And how tough it is. This book, Ann Thompson, also talks about how tough it is for the really good indie films to find an audience, to find a niche. That the way things are marketed now is different. Films don't have a chance to build up word of mouth. They don't have a chance to get a foothold in a particular city and then go to another city and stay on our radar for longer periods of time. And so then you think about the creativity that's getting stifled because they're too busy putting together another Avengers film or looking for the next non-John Carter kind of bomb.
But
it is kind of interesting reading about the bombs and where all that money's going and who's taking the hit in the pocketbook. But so, like I said, I'm only about halfway through, but it's just fascinating and it reads like water. And
the $11 billion year from Sundance to the Oscars, an inside look at the changing Hollywood system, right?
Yes, that's $11 billion year.
Okay. Jeff, let's go to This is the Story of a Happy Marriage, the author Ann Patchett.
That's right, Steve. And Ann Patchett is best known as a novelist, and probably her best-known novels are Bel Canto and State of Wonder. But for my money, her best book is The Magician's Assistant. But this is a collection of 22 essays, and most of them had previously been published as magazine pieces. Hmm. There's a couple of longer pieces that appeared on the internet, and they function as kind of an accidental or piecemeal autobiography. Mm-hmm. So we learn a lot about Ann Patchett. She was raised a Catholic. Her parents divorced, and then her mother remarried a surgeon who was a really colorful character. He built a hangar in their front yard and landed his helicopter there. And she had really a very dislocated, disjunctive childhood. So by the time she ended up in parochial school in third grade, she could not read. Mm. Ann Patchett, the writer, could not read in third grade.
Wow.
And a nun took her under her wing and made her stay in for recess and after school and taught her to read. Mm. And Ann Patchett is a consummate caretaker, and that nun, Sister Nina, comes in for some caretaking by Patchett at the end. Of course, another Patchett book is Truth and Beauty, in which she took care of the writer Lucy Greeley, who overdosed at age 39. Mm. But even though Patchett is a practicing Catholic, I thought two of the most interesting essays in the book were about divorce. The Sacrament of Divorce is about Patchett's early disastrous first marriage. She got married in graduate school, and she said she knew even before she got to the altar, I should not be doing this, but I'm in too far.
Right.
And then she and her husband were sharing an academic position, and she just bolted, left her husband, left the position, went home, worked as a waitress in Nashville, and wrote her first book. But she makes a very convincing argument that divorce is a necessary part of our lives. You know, when people are suffering and miserable, it's an important exit. Mm-hmm. And so that's why it's called The Sacrament of Divorce. This is the story of a happy marriage. Sounds like it would be a really sentimental essay. It's anything but sentimental. Okay, so Patchett herself leaves the marriage early. Her parents, divorce. Her mom marries two more times. In fact, when she gets married, was it the first time or the second time? Her mom has gotten reengaged to the guy. Anyway, you know, a lot of divorce in the family. So she's both kind of have a history of divorce, wired for divorce, and wary of divorce. When the doctor that her mom works for wants to court her and wants to marry her. And she keeps saying, I am the last person you should marry. Mm. And she says this for 11 years until he gets what appears to be a terminal diagnosis. And she gets really panicking and thinks, we have to get married so I can make medical decisions about his care.
Wow.
So they get married, and then he pinks up, gets healthy, and they live happily ever after.
Wow,
so,
wow.
She's a wonderful writer.
And this is wonderful in audio. I listened to it, and it's narrated by Ann Patchett.
Hmm.
And she sounds like someone you would want to have a beer or a glass of wine with.
Absolutely.
She's so down to earth. And her chapter on running that bookstore is a blueprint for how someone starts an indie bookstore now in this sort
of client. That's
interesting.
I'd like to read that. I'd be interested in reading that. Again, the book doctors are in the house. We're visiting today about a whole host of good books they're reading. Katie Stover, Jeff Ann Gowdy, Steve Paul, and Grace Suh. Steve Paul, The Burglary by Betty Metzger.
Yeah, this is you may have heard something about this a couple months ago. It's really a fascinating story of modern American history. This book tells the tale of a group of peace activists in the early in 1971 in Philadelphia who, over a period of a couple months, planned and pulled off a burglary in a small FBI office in suburban Philadelphia, Media, Pennsylvania.
Of an FBI office?
Of an FBI
office. Like
there's
jewelry inside the FBI office?
No. There are files in the FBI office, and they managed to steal all of them. One night, it was the night of the big Fraser Ali fight, and they figured that because there are apartments above this FBI office, that everybody in the neighborhood would be watching television, the boxing match, and they planned this burglary the night of. It was eight people who were serious, kind of nonviolent peace activists, and inspired by Daniel Berrigan and other things that were going on at the time. And what they wanted to do was to expose the FBI's spying, various programs to spy on American citizens, to spy on anti-war activists, to spy on black students at campuses around the country. And so they managed to pull off this burglary. And within a few weeks, they begin distributing the files that expose the FBI and basically bring down J. Edgar Hoover. Wow. He died about a year later, but it was a remarkable thing. But one of the amazing things, one of the amazing parts of this story is that they were never caught. They were never identified. Even though there were eight of them, the story of this burglary didn't come out until a couple months ago when this book was released. And
were you one of the eight?
There is an unnamed guy in here. No, I was not one of the eight, but I certainly lived through that period as some of the rest of us did. They kept this secret for 40 years. It's rather, you know, they inspired Daniel Ellsberg. I mean, it ended up leading to any number of great breakthroughs in intelligence and about our government and governmental activities. Just following the story of how they did it, how they got away with it, about all the close calls that happened. I mean, there were investigations. I mean, the FBI showed up on their, one of their doorsteps.
Wow.
But then never
came back.
And it's like
that sounds terrific.
It is terrific. The book is long. It's in depth. It goes through. It digresses here and there, and it also kind of repeats itself here and there. So it's a little bloated. I find myself kind of wanting to skip ahead from time to time. But it is a fascinating book of American history that.
That book, again, is titled The Burglary from Steve Paul. Okay, Grace Saw, let's go on to the collected stories of Mavis Gallant.
Oh, if I could inspire any single person out there to read any story of Mavis Gallant, I will have considered my life a success because she is one of my favorite writers of all time, and I think it's one of the hugest injustices that she is so little known, even among big book people.
Yeah.
But I will say that if I had to choose between her and Alice Munro, I would choose Mavis Gallant.
Well, that's high praise indeed.
That's right. Ew. That is how much I believe in her. And I guess I went to Alice Munro because they are roughly contemporaneous. They're both women Canadian writers brought up in a time when there weren't very many women writers. And but she has a very different life. She had an urban upbringing. She was sent to French Catholic boarding school at the age of four,
mm-hmm.
Was basically an orphan and went as a young person to live in Paris and lived there ever since. She died a week and a half ago at the age of 91, and she lived in Paris all of her life. I have here the 900-page collected stories of Mavis Gallant. However, the New York Review of Books has issued three very small, very pretty volumes. One's called The Cost of Living, one's called Varieties of Exile, one's called Paris Stories. I have two of them, and they're very nice places to start. But I will just say that for wit, for elegance, for compression, for intelligence, her stories are just such, you know, they really reward you, and they're just such beautifully worked pieces of fiction.
That's the collected stories of Mavis Gallant. Great recommendation. High praise coming from Grace for that book. Katie Stover, The Storied Life of A.J. Fickrey.
Oh, yes. This book is a delight. It was just one of the top reads for the Library Reads indie book list that librarians across the nation are putting together. And The Storied Life of A.J. Fickrey by Gabriel Zevin is a book for lovers of books. It opens with A.J. Fickrey. He's an independent bookstore owner in this small town. And
we're all drawn to stories about independent bookstore owners, aren't we? What is that about?
Been there, done that.
The romance is gone. Imagine that. Mr. Brookside himself, Steve Paul. Yeah.
This book is a real charmer because its lead character is a little bit of a curmudgeon, but he's also grieving the death of his wife. And he runs his bookstore with a little bit of a curmudgeonly attitude. I guess that's part of the charm, why people will come in and buy books from him. But his life is turned around when someone leaves something behind at his bookstore, just tucks it, leaves it in the children's section, and what's left behind is a baby. Now, that sounds rather pat, and now you kind of think you know where this book is going. And it's just the way AJ decides to care for this child. He's using passages from books like Telltale Heart from Edgar Allan Poe and some Ray Bradbury. And he's using these passages as guidance for how he's going to take care of this child until social services appears and takes this kid off AJ's hands, because he doesn't want to be a father. He doesn't want to do that. And in the meantime, a couple of subplots. He's got a police chief who wants to start a book club for other police officers. And now that sounds rather fantastical to someone like me, because it's really hard to get men to come out and discuss anything in a group, especially their books. They're talking about books. They're just not talking about it in a book group in a library.
Yeah.
But that's just one of the subplots. And this book is full of a lot of charm, but it's got a nice, refined literary sensibility. And it moves a lot quicker than I thought it would. It's going to be one of those under-the-radar books that librarians and booksellers and readers pass amongst themselves. It's going to be a book club favorite.
The Storied Life of A.J. Fickrey.
Yes.
Okay. Jeff Van Gowdy, you had a couple left on your list that both intrigued me a little bit. How to Read a Novelist by John Freeman and Remarkable Kansas Women by a woman named Gina Kaufman, who's making big news around the KCUR studios these days as our upcoming host here.
Yay.
So go ahead.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, I think we're kind of under the gun on time.
We
so
are under the
I'll
gun.
Be brief here. John Freeman's, I heard him when he was a guest on your show,
yeah.
Steve. Wonderful things to say about book reviewing. This is a collection of profiles of author interviews. And one thing that interested me was he said when he initially started doing the interviews, he would come in with 20 prepared questions. And what he found was prepared questions lead to prepared answers.
Uh-huh.
So now he comes in with a tape recorder and not a single prepared question.
Yes, I was struck by that, too.
Yeah.
As someone who lives that walk every day in here. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I always have my 20 prepared questions when I do my magazine profiles.
Yeah.
Anyway, these read with a lot of depth, and most of them are about extremely well-known American authors, but there's lots of international authors as well. So definitely a book to read. And a timely book, since this is National Women's History Month, which we've celebrated in the United States.
And National Gina Kaufman Recognition
Gina
Month
Kaufman.
As well.
Yeah. Yes. Remarkable Kansas Women. And it's 12 chapters, 11 women who were born in the 19th century profiled, and then one chapter devoted to Harvey girls. Many of the people I was familiar with, because I'm married to a Kansas history buff, but also lesser known people.
Yeah.
Like Nora Holt, who was the first African-American to get a master's in music.
Huh. Great book there from Remarkable Kansas Women by Gina Kaufman, and How to Read a Novelist by John Freeman. We're out of time. I want to thank Katie Stover, Jeff Van Gowdy, Steve Paul, and Grace Sudd. Thanks, guys, for coming in. Always good to have you guys.
Always
thanks.
A pleasure
always
for
welcome.
Having us.
Doctors, yeah. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. Tomorrow on the program, we take a look at the murder that helped prompt the development of the 9/11 emergency phone system, and 49 people heard the attack but did nothing. Plus, the poet laureate of Missouri joins us. That's tomorrow. Our show is produced by Steven Steigman, Danny Alexander, Beth Lipoff, and Cody Newell. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.